Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Rise to Rebellion by Jeff Shara, narrated by George Goodell. This work is copyrighted 2001 by Jeffrey Shara. This recording is copyrighted 2001 by Recorded Books. Jeff Shara opens with the following note. This is the first volume of a two-part story of the American Revolution, as told from the points of view of several of the key participants. This book follows the timeline from the first bloodshed in Boston in March 1770 through the summer of 1776. While the events and the people are real and true to history, this is not what you may have read in high school history class. By definition, this is a novel. As painstaking as I try to be in telling you this story through the voices of the characters themselves, in their own words and through their own experiences, the dialogue and thoughts must be read as fiction. I'm often asked about the source material, the research itself. Few subjects in American history are as well chronicled as the American Revolution. More specifically, some of these characters have been so focused upon that their names fill entire shelves in libraries. Wherever possible, my research takes me through their letters and memoirs, their diaries, their own written histories, or the accounts written by the people who were there. In telling you their stories from their points of view, it is essential that the research take me into their minds. It then becomes my task to bring those voices to you. One immediate observation about this time in American history is the unique language of the era. As my father, Michael Shara, noted in his introduction to The Killer Angels, in the 1860s, men spoke in windy phrases. Going back to the 1770s, the style of speech is windier still. Occasionally, I've toned down some of the more complex language of the time, with significant exceptions. I have not changed any direct quote, nor have I altered the wording of any written document. I've made every effort not to pollute the characterizations by including any anachronistic words or inappropriately modern references. This is primarily the story of this time as told through the eyes of Benjamin Franklin, John and Abigail Adams, General Thomas Gage, and George Washington. While I do not attempt to convey or explain every event, every important incident, every factor that carried America to the point of revolution, I have tried to show how each of these characters responded to his or her time, how they witnessed and experienced and impacted the enormous changes unfolding around them. It has become fashionable in our modern, more cynical time to re-examine our history, to throw a supposedly new light on those who are famous for their accomplishments, to instead expose their faults, to topple the statue of the hero, to replace the honor and respect with the sensational and the shameful, as though it were the only meaningful way these characters can be relevant to today's world. I most adamantly disagree. That we know so much about these characters today is a testament to their accomplishments, their extraordinary achievements, and yes, their astounding heroism. That they can so easily become targets is a testament to their humanity. They are, after all, so very much like us. Measuring their behavior with the crystal clarity of hindsight, with 21st century standards and judgments, is a convenient and cynical shortcut to learning history. But it does little to help us understand their character and why they deserve to be not only remembered, but revered. The American Revolution is not merely a story about great battles. The Revolution itself was about not just the power of armies, but the power of a people to decide their own future. This story allows you, the reader, to witness the very birth of our nation through the eyes of the wonderful men and women who, by their integrity, sacrifice, and astounding courage, caused it to happen. It is a story that belongs to every American. Jeff Shara, October 2000. And now, Rise to Rebellion.
Introduction. When 22-year-old King George III ascends to the throne of England in 1760, he inherits an empire that is struggling financially, and worse, he inherits a war. The enemy is France, as for centuries it has always been. The war in Europe is called the Seven Years' War. But the conflict between the two great powers has spread well beyond the European continent for the first time. Both countries now have serious colonial interests in North America, and thus the war spreads there as well, involving soldiers not only from the two nations themselves, but from their colonies and from the native population. It is referred to by the colonists as the French and Indian War. The war is ultimately won by the British, the largest spoils being Canada and the islands of the West Indies. To the American colonists, the greatest prize is peace along most of the Indian frontier. In England, the king and his ministers are desperate to shore up the British economy, to rebuild its treasury after the devastating financial cost of the war. The king is essentially a decent, caring man who has been taught from birth that his first priority is to preserve his empire, to demonstrate a benevolent yet firm control over his subjects. He is said to have received a brief piece of advice that he will take to heart all his life. Be a king. Yet George is not an especially clever or resourceful man, and he is easily manipulated by the cunning and ambitious men around him. One of these men is George Grenville, who serves as Chancellor of the Exchequer, in effect the Empire's treasurer. Grenville is a miserly and hostile man whose narrow view of the world is punctuated by a sharpened pencil. To help solve England's financial woes, Grenville pushes through Parliament a series of acts aimed at raising money from the growing economy of the American colonies. The acts include new taxes on the importation of sugar, restrictions on colonial credit, restrictions on the importation of goods into the colonies from territories outside the empire, and the right of the British military to billet their troops in private homes without the householder's consent. But the most controversial of Grenville's acts, the tax that will impact the greatest number of colonists, is the Stamp Act, news of which arrives on colonial shores in 1765. The Stamp Act requires a royal tax stamp to be affixed on any newspaper, pamphlet, public document, or legal contract, and even on the tools of wagering, such as playing cards and dice. From the British point of view, the Stamp Act is a legitimate means of requiring the colonies to pay the cost of British military protection and their share of the cost of the French and Indian War. The British are astounded to learn that the colonies take a decidedly different point of view. There are immediate protests in the colonies, claims that the new taxes will cause severe financial hardship. Then a sharp cry begins to spread throughout the colonies. Taxation without representation is tyranny. The phrase is taken from a famous speech given to King Charles I by John Hampden in 1638, but it receives a new and significantly passionate following. It has historically been regarded as illegal for Parliament to levy any tax in the colonies being granted by the British Constitution the power to tax themselves. But what further angers the colonists is that they are never allowed to send their own representatives to Parliament, that they have no one to speak for them on where or how these taxes might be used. No argument over this issue has been made in England for nearly 40 years. In that time, the colonies have grown more populous and more prosperous and have formed a much stronger sense of identity separate from their English roots. None of this is understood by the officials in London, who are charged with managing colonial affairs. The colonists begin to hear of an organized resistance to what is being described as blatant abuses of colonial liberties. In Boston, the name of Samuel Adams emerges. Adams is the 43-year-old son of a respected deacon, church founder, and businessman. Adams is Harvard-educated but has never seemed capable of sustaining himself in either business or law. He is most notable for his huge personal debts. But Adams has a talent for rallying the citizens to a cause and is a principal founder of the Sons of Liberty, the name adapted from a pro-colonial speech given in Parliament by Isaac Barré. Under Adams' skilled hand, the Sons quickly evolve into an effective voice for organizing and mobilizing opposition to what they see as the abuses of the Grenville Acts. Adams understands the value of the printing press, and for the first time, the newspaper becomes a valuable tool for propaganda. The impact of the Sons spreads throughout the colonies, and soon similar groups of the same name spring up in most of the larger towns along the Atlantic coast. Adams and the other leaders of the Sons, Dr. Joseph Warren, John Hancock, and many others, begin a well-orchestrated and well-publicized manipulation of public opinion that results in outbreaks of violence against anyone in the colonies who might support the acts, including anyone who has accepted the lucrative position of royal tax collector. They tar and feather their opponents with relative impunity, instigate riots in Boston, and destroy the home of the then-Lieutenant Governor Thomas Hutchinson. Pressure to repeal the acts comes from Parliament as well, and the colonial radicals learn they have support in that body. Besides Barré, other members of Parliament begin to speak out against the King's policies, notably John Wilkes, William Pitt, and Edmund Burke. Bowing to the pressure, Parliament repeals the acts in 1766, and Grenville's career is over. The repeal has two effects. It spawns a growing resentment in England over the disrespect the colonies show their mother country, and it emboldens the colonies as they realize that they may in fact have an impact on their own future. The resentment fuels King George's efforts to find other ways to make the colonies feed the royal treasury. In 1767, Grenville's successor, Sir Charles Townshend, proposes what are known as the Townshend Acts, a clumsy attempt at levying another series of taxes on a long list of goods, including paper, ink, paint, glass, lead, and tea. In addition, the Act calls for employees of the Crown serving in the colonies to be paid out of colonial treasuries for the first time, thus eliminating any colonial influence in the management of many government offices. The Townshend Acts are as unpopular as the Stamp Act, and when Townshend dies soon after their passage, opposition both in America and in Parliament brings about their repeal as well. As a compromise and an effort to placate the King, Parliament keeps only one small clause of the Acts in effect: the barely noticeable tax on tea. In 1768, King George appoints Sir Will Hills, 1st Duke of Hillsborough, to serve as the first agent for colonial affairs. It is Hillsborough's job to manage and secure colonial cooperation with the King's government, but King George has chosen a man whose primary qualification for the position is his friendship with the King. Hillsborough responds to controversy and protest from the colonies with a heavy hand, prescribing military force as the most effective remedy for any unrest. It is his order that sends a large garrison of troops to Boston to support the beleaguered civil authority. In Massachusetts, the civil unrest has so rattled the generally incompetent royal governor, Francis Bernard, that he sails to England, confronting the problem by simply abandoning the colony. In his place, Lieutenant Governor Hutchinson assumes control and agrees with Lord Hillsborough's deployment of British troops. The presence of the troops is incendiary at best, and the Sons of Liberty make the most of the public's fears of and antipathy toward such a visible military presence. With King George's insistence on treating the colonies in any way that suits him, combined with the inability of either Hillsborough or Lord North, the King's Prime Minister, to comprehend the climate of their citizens 3,000 miles away, the English government continues to impose restrictive and inflammatory laws on the American colonies. Despite the dire warnings of his political opposition in Parliament, King George begins to enjoy the heat of politics, begins to find sport in the conflicts, begins to believe the use of his army may be the most attractive solution to dealing with the annoying groundswell of protest and the gathering of angry voices from some of the most prominent men of his time. Benjamin Franklin. Born in 1706 in Boston, Franklin grows up in the home of a working-class family, and in his mid-teens, he apprentices in his older brother's printing shop. He develops a wanderlust and runs away from home. Eventually, he finds himself in Philadelphia, essentially broke and homeless, and talks himself into a job at a print shop. By age 24, he is half-owner of the business, which includes a weekly newspaper, the Philadelphia Gazette. Though competition is stiff in the dynamic, growing city, Franklin takes his business straight to the hearts of the common people. When the streets are the busiest, and thus the audience the largest, he makes a show of delivering his papers himself, struggling with an old, heavily laden wheelbarrow. His printing business soon becomes the most successful in the city, and Franklin ultimately buys out his partner. In September 1730, he marries Deborah Reed, who gives birth to a son and a daughter. The son dies at age 4, a sorrow of which Franklin will rarely speak. Franklin has one other illegitimate son, William, born shortly after his marriage, the product of a liaison that Franklin himself acknowledges in uncomplimentary ways. "That hard to be governed passion of youth hurried me frequently into intrigues with low women that fell in my way." Though Deborah accepts William as a part of the family, their relationship is never as close as mother and son. In 1732, Franklin begins his long odyssey as a writer, revealing a flair for humor, sarcasm, and biting satire. Poor Richard's Almanac is the most popular magazine of its time and appears regularly for 27 years. It also makes Franklin a wealthy man. He soon founds a debating society he calls the Junto, which eventually becomes the American Philosophical Society. He becomes one of Philadelphia's most well-known citizens by his acts of public improvement, including founding a library and the first fire department in Pennsylvania. In 1751, he recognizes the urgent need for education, and thus founds an academy that will eventually become the University of Pennsylvania. Franklin displays an amazing talent for invention and an interest in scientific experiments, and in 1752 he embarks on his famous kite experiment, proving the direct relationship between lightning and electricity. He enters government service for the first time in 1751 as a member of the Pennsylvania Assembly. He is appointed by King George II as Postmaster General for the colonies, a position he holds for 22 years. He visits England for the first time in 1757 and quickly develops a love affair for that nation that will keep him there for more years than he spends at home. His wife is desperately afraid of traveling on water, and so the Franklins will spend much of their later life apart. Traveling extensively throughout Europe, he impresses the elite of both government and academe with his intellect and charm, and by middle age he is the darling of England and the continent, with a considerable reputation for diplomacy and scientific knowledge. His frequent presence in England makes convenient his appointment as colonial agent for the colony of Pennsylvania in 1764. Other colonies recognize the value of the man's celebrity, and within a few years he receives the same appointments from Georgia, New Jersey, and, finally, Massachusetts. On one trip to London, he is accompanied by his son, William. He succeeds in bringing his son to the attention of powerful friends, and in 1763, William is appointed Royal Governor of New Jersey. With the passage of Grenville's Stamp Act, Franklin's distance from the colonies blinds him to the inevitability of protests, and he even secures a position for a friend in Philadelphia as royal tax collector. When he learns of the violent outpouring of protest, Franklin begins to understand how much has changed in his absence, and following the advice of friends in America, he works tirelessly for the repeal of the Stamp Act, for which he rarely receives credit. As a friend to so many in high places, he begins to hear more and more of the blatant prejudice toward colonial citizens and the high-handed dismissal of colonial claims and concerns. He regularly observes that the British hierarchy is terribly removed from the reality of their policy's consequences. He contemplates returning to Philadelphia, but cannot bring himself to leave London. He understands that his serious work on behalf of the colonies he represents may be just beginning. John Adams. John Adams is born in 1735 in Braintree, Massachusetts, to undistinguished parents. His family, Adams says, cut down more trees than anyone in the colony. His father's life as a farmer holds great appeal for the boy, who from his earliest days has a great love of the land. But his father is ambitious and sends the boy to school. Against his father's wishes, Adams' mother pushes him toward the ministry. And Adams considers that direction, but he changes his mind when he observes local church services and the fierceness of disagreement so inherent in the religion of the time. He finds immediate frustration in a career where the answers cannot be analyzed on paper, and he cannot take to a field where he finds himself involved in difficulties beyond my power of decision. He continues to distance himself from the dominance of religion in the local culture, and in 1756 he writes, "Where do we find precepts in the gospel requiring convocations, councils, decrees, creeds, confession, oaths, subscriptions, and whole cartloads of other trumpery that we find religion encumbered with in these days?" Adams discovers a talent for science and math, but when he graduates from Harvard in 1755, he accepts the practicality of a more financially beneficial career in law. There are no law schools in the colonies at this time. He apprentices for 3 years and is finally admitted to the bar in 1758. He begins the arduous task of building a law practice in a field dominated by older, much more established lawyers, and actually comes to resent the time he wasted in all his former pursuits. He carves his path with a natural affinity for reading, study, and hard work, and accumulates the finest law library in the colony. No matter his self-imposed workload, he never strays long from his beloved farmlands. He spends much time just wandering the open woods around his family's home. At one point he records in his diary, "Rambled about all day, gaping and gazing." As he puts it, "Exercise invigorates and enlivens all the faculties of body and of mind. It spreads a gladness and satisfaction over our minds and qualifies us for every sort of business and every sort of pleasure." In 1764, after a long and thoroughly charming courtship, he marries Abigail Smith, the daughter of a minister. Though without a formal education, which was often ruled to be illegal for women at this time, she has a hunger for knowledge and is a voracious reader, particularly of the classics and history. As events around Boston become more tumultuous, she is an unusually keen observer of the forces at work, and unlike so many of her female contemporaries, she is not afraid to state her opinion. Because of Adams' law practice, he is in close touch with the politics of the day, and he begins to write for the local newspaper with a clarity of analysis that brings him to the attention of prominent members of the Massachusetts Assembly. In 1765, he joins the outcry against the Stamp Act and authors a resolution of protest to the Assembly. Though he is second cousin to the older and much more well-known Sam Adams, John never becomes active in the Sons of Liberty. He is consumed instead by the requirements of his law practice. In 1768, he buys a small house in Boston, a necessity for an aspiring young lawyer. He finds himself called to service in higher-profile cases, and he successfully defends the colony's wealthiest citizen, John Hancock, against charges of smuggling, a charge that everyone in Massachusetts knows to be true. Torn between his love of the law and his love of the farm, Adams tries to maintain both lifestyles, often at a cost to his health. When the British send troops into Boston in 1768, his eyes are too focused on his law books for him to fully grasp the potential for disaster. George Washington. Born in 1732 in Westmoreland County, Virginia, Washington lives as a young boy with his half-brother Lawrence at Lawrence's estate, Mount Vernon, and later at his mother's home near Fredericksburg. He receives little education, with no formal studies after the age of 15. Though he has a talent for mathematics, it is not attractive to him as a career until age 16, when his brother offers him an opportunity to serve as a land surveyor. This provides him a reasonable salary, which the young man desperately needs. He grows into a huge figure of a man, described by a friend as 6'2" in his stockings, weighing 175 pounds, with well-developed muscles, wide-shouldered, neat-waisted, blue-gray and rather penetrating eyes. In 1748 he accompanies Lawrence to the island of Barbados, where his brother seeks a cure for his consumption. Washington catches smallpox, recovers, and then spends most of the journey locked in the agony of seasickness. He vows never again to cross an ocean. When Lawrence dies in 1752, Washington inherits Mount Vernon and settles down to a new life as a gentleman farmer. As is customary throughout the southern farm country, Mount Vernon is worked primarily by slaves. As word reaches Virginia of a rise in hostilities between the British and French, both nations holding claim to the frontier of western Virginia, Washington joins the Virginia militia, receiving a commission as lieutenant colonel. In 1754, Governor Robert Dinwiddie instructs him to lead two companies of troops through hostile Indian territory to the French trading outposts to communicate the king's warning to the French to vacate the area. The French dismiss the warnings, and on his own accord, Washington attacks and engages a French armed force, which he defeats at the Battle of Great Meadows. Thus, in May 1754, he fires the first shots of what will become the French and Indian War. But his strategy is unwise, and his forces are easily cut off from their base. 2 months later, Washington's men are surrounded by a revenge-minded French army, and he is forced to surrender. He is allowed to leave the wilderness and returns to civilization to his first taste of the prejudice toward colonial soldiers from the regular British forces. His own reputation is thought by some to be tarnished beyond repair. A year later, Washington is ordered to accompany British General Edward Braddock on a march to attack and drive the French away from their strong outpost at the head of the Ohio River. Displaying the arrogance that will hound the British military mind for generations, Braddock dismisses Washington's advice to prepare for the unusual tactics of the French and their Indian allies, and marches his men in tight formation straight into a trap. Braddock himself is killed, as are 3/4 of his officers, and it is Washington's cool-headedness in engineering a retreat that allows the few survivors to withdraw. Upon his return to eastern Virginia, Washington is rewarded with a promotion to full colonel, but still receives no respect from the British command and is denied a commission in the British regular army. For the rest of the war, he commands a few hundred militia along a loose boundary of the Indian frontier, a frustrating experience that teaches him a great deal about the uselessness of most local militias. In 1758, he accompanies British General John Forbes in an advance against Fort Duquesne, what will later become Pittsburgh, and observes more British arrogance in their clumsy plan of assault. But before the poor British tactics have a chance to fail, the French withdraw. Thus, Forbes claims victory, and Washington's military accomplishments come to be regarded in Virginia with considerable respect. In 1759, he greatly misses life at Mount Vernon and has tired of the high-handed arrogance of the British command, so he resigns his commission and returns home. He envelops himself in the joys of working the land and develops new farming techniques by experimenting with different soil treatments, including techniques he has observed being used by the Indians. That year, he marries Martha Dandridge Custis, a widow who has inherited an immense estate from her husband's death. The combination makes the Washingtons one of Virginia's wealthiest couples. Martha has two children from her former marriage, only one of whom survives to adulthood. The couple never produced their own child. His new financial status is nearly an automatic ticket to a seat in the Virginia House of Burgesses. But he does not seem to have a flair for politics, and has already been bruised by the arrogant dismissal and hasty judgment at the hands of the British. He settles into quiet political obscurity, rarely involving himself in the acrimonious debates that begin to roll through Virginia. Unlike his contemporaries, Patrick Henry and Richard Henry Lee, Washington has no gift for oratory. As controversy heats up in Boston and loud voices in Virginia begin to criticize royal policy, the governor dissolves the House of Burgesses, which begins to meet on its own accord. Washington awakens to the new crisis spreading throughout the colonies, and the debates take on new importance. As the talk grows hotter, the great minds who speak out with such eloquence turn their attention more and more to this huge, quiet, and unassuming man who, more than any of the rest of them, has already demonstrated he knows something of how to be a soldier. Lieutenant General Thomas Gage. Born in 1720 in Firle, England, Gage is the second son of a moderately successful member of Parliament. His father's position allows the boy to attend the prestigious Westminster Public School, which opens connections into the Royal Military Service. He receives his first commission as ensign in 1740, is promoted to captain 3 years later, and serves in a variety of posts in various conflicts in Scotland and the Netherlands. In 1754, he is made a major and sent to America, where he serves under Edward Braddock. He is one of the few officers who survive Braddock's disaster, and by most accounts, he is one of the bright lights for the British that day. Gage will recall well the heroic action of a Virginia colonel named George Washington. Though he and Washington establish something of a friendship, their lack of contact prevents it from deepening. Ordered northward, Gage spends time in Albany, New York, as well as New York City, and does a brief stint in Halifax, Nova Scotia. In 1757, he is given his own regiment and promoted to full colonel. The following year, he takes part in campaigns against the French up the Hudson River. He displays a talent rare in the British officer corps, compassion for the men in his command. He is enormously popular among his troops. To fight the constant plague of scurvy that affects men stationed in a land far from the benefits of fresh vegetables, he replaces their ration of beer with apple cider. When his responsibilities allow, he makes frequent visits to New York City. His close friend, General Jeffrey Amherst, commander-in-chief for the Army in America, is there, and Gage participates in the New York social scene, where he meets Margaret Kemble, the daughter of a prominent New Jersey political figure. They are married in late 1758, and she will bear him 8 children. Margaret is an aspiring socialite, envies the cream of New York elite, and must endure their snobbery toward her New Jersey upbringing. Gage returns to duty, accompanied by his new wife, and commands his regiment in the actions along the St. Lawrence River and the Niagara Valley. When the French surrender Canada in 1760, Gage becomes military governor and spends 3 years in what he describes as the misery of Montreal. He possesses the peculiarly English prejudice toward Catholics, who now comprise most of his constituency. Despite this, when he leaves the post, he is regarded in Montreal as having been extremely successful in governing a difficult situation. He is promoted to Major General in 1761, and when Amherst returns to England, Gage is named Commander-in-Chief of the British Forces in America and promoted to Lieutenant General. In 1763, he establishes his headquarters in New York City, where he will maintain his residence for most of the next 13 years. During the decade that follows, His role is that of a firm protector of British interests in a colonial land, and he is an efficient administrator. As the protests over the Stamp Act escalate, he begins to see the Sons of Liberty as an annoyance, but he gives little consideration to the growing tide of sentiment against the King's policies. He is appalled when Parliament repeals the Townshend Acts, believing that if he had been given sufficient troop strength, he could have put down any protest by force and thus saved face for the King. But while Gage is an efficient officer, he will never initiate policy. He follows orders, which come via the agonizingly slow route from London. The messages go both ways, and to the sympathetic ear of Lord Hillsborough, Gage begins to champion the use of brute force and the hangman's noose as the means of restoring order and putting the Sons of Liberty in their proper place. But the politics of London is a morass of conflicting reports, inefficient and corrupt ministers, and an ongoing lack of awareness that Gage is actually facing the possibility of a significant uprising. Though Gage never really believes the Sons of Liberty pose a threat to his authority or to the general peace in the colonies, he begins to send requests to London calling for more troops to be added to the enormous scope of his command. Despite all the turmoil of the political protests, the last half of the 1760s are the happiest years of Gage's life. He and his government in London are blissfully unaware that the angry forces in the colonies they so blithely dismiss are pushing them toward a series of shattering events with an impact no one on either side can predict. Part 1. The Right and the Power. Chapter 1. The Century. March 5th, 1770. He had been in Boston for nearly 18 months, had come ashore with the rest of His Majesty's 29th Regiment after a miserable journey down from Halifax. The troops had been summoned to the boats by their commander, General Thomas Gage, had been told only that they were going to the Massachusetts colony to maintain the peace. Few had any idea how that peace might be threatened, and nearly all saw the journey as an escape from the lonely isolation of the King's most northern port. When they finally marched out of the cramped warships, they moved into a town where the people did not welcome them, did not provide homes or hospitality. Now, after nearly 2 years, the conflicts between the citizens of Boston and the soldiers had become more than the unpleasant argument, the occasional barroom brawl. The discipline of the troops had begun to slip. Men became frustrated by the hostility around them, the taunts and minor assaults. And when the officers were not close, many of the soldiers had begun to strike back. The citizens had responded to the anger of the troops with anger of their own, and gangs of young men armed with clubs and the occasional saber began to patrol the dark alleys outside the pubs and meeting places of the soldiers. The fights were more numerous now and were sometimes bloody. While the local magistrates were quick to arrest and prosecute, both sides protected their own, and no one had any illusion that the law could protect the innocent. Inspired by the newspaper men, who presented each incident in passionate detail, playing up the seething hostility, the citizens were more and more restless, fueling the growing anger toward the British troops. To many civilians, this military occupation was oppressive, and even those most loyal to the policies of London recognized that the presence of the troops was dangerous. With the right spark, the minor disturbances could explode into a bloody disaster. His name was Hugh White, and he had served in the 29th Regiment for nearly 3 years. He had little ambition, had no particular designs on promotion, considered the corporal above him to be a far better soldier. He rarely spoke to the officers, was not a face or a name that anyone would ever single out. But today, he had been singled out, given a job that most in his company would dread. The duty was not for punishment of some indiscreet act, it was simply his turn. And so he stood guard in front of the custom house, shivering against the sharp cold in a small wooden guardhouse, standing sentry to a place that would rarely attract attention. He moved around as much as the cramped space would allow, touched the walls on three sides of him, felt the rough, cold wood. His fingers were numb, and he flexed them, then pushed one hand hard inside his coat. He glanced out beyond the guardhouse and saw only a few citizens moving quickly through the cold, ignoring him. He cast a glance down toward his hidden hand, bulging in his coat, flexed his fingers again, worried about being seen. He thought of the drill the week before, the sergeant scolding the men to keep their decorum, maintain their dignity, especially on guard duty. That meant hands by your side. He eased his head outside the guardhouse, looked toward the doorway of the custom house, saw no one, felt relief. Perhaps even that old sergeant would understand, he thought. It's just too cold. He put his other hand inside the rough wool, pulled his arms up tight. He blew out a sharp breath, thinking that if he stood up stiff the way they told him to, his fingers would probably fall off. The musket leaned up against the wall close beside him, a light glaze of frost on the black steel. The guardhouse was really only a narrow box, not much larger than an upright coffin. But it kept away the awful bite of the wind, the sharp cold that blew deep into your bones. Early that morning, the assignment of guard duty had made him smile, and if the others laughed and teased him, he had only thought of relieving the boredom of the barracks. Now he imagined what the others were doing, playing cards, the profane talk. His father had warned him of the bad influences, and he could still see his mother's tear-stained face watching as her boy marched away to join this army. "She didn't want me to go," he thought. "They expected me to work that land," he thought, "still expect me to just come home and be a farmer like them. They don't know anything else." He remembered the look on their faces when he had come home, the brief visit before the 29th had boarded the great ship to sail west. He had stood tall, waited as his father moved around him, inspecting the uniform, even touching the dull red coat, could still see his mother's shock, her young boy now grown into this soldier. Their response had disappointed him. They had not seemed as proud as he had expected. Seemed more worried instead, gave him more sharp scolding to keep himself clean, to avoid the awful deadly temptations that only a parent fears. "I wish they could see me now," he thought. "This is important, guarding the custom house." He hadn't even been inside the building, but he knew the rumors. There was supposed to be a huge vault filled with silver, the customs duties paid by the ships as they brought their goods into the port from England or from the islands far to the south. He hoped it was true, had no reason to doubt the importance of his duty, was proud of his responsibility guarding the king's currency. If those chaps back in the barracks knew how much this post means to the king, they wouldn't laugh. They'd be out here doing the duty. He glanced at the musket, then out again to the wide street, the hard-packed ice and snow, heard the stiff breeze whistling through the cracks in the crude wooden walls of the guardhouse. He wanted to drift away, try to imagine the scene, Private White holding away the bandits with his bayonet, ordering the riffraff to move away. And his mind spoke out, the voice loud and firm, "In the name of the king!" He shivered now, and the image wouldn't stay. He wriggled his fingers again, glanced toward the street once more. The locals didn't much care for them, he knew. He wasn't educated in politics. Few of the private soldiers were. They had been surprised at the hostility from many of the citizens, and when they had marched away from the ships, they had been told that they would have to camp on Boston Common, since there were no open doors for them in private homes. But camping outdoors in tents could be deadly through the New England winter, and the commanders had struggled frantically to find accommodations. Finally, those in the town, whom the officers called Tories, and who did not seem so resentful of the troops, began to open their doors, leasing buildings and warehouses, some even renting out their own homes. Now 2 winters had passed, and the duty was mostly monotonous, painfully boring. He had spent much of his time simply standing at drill in the common, marching in formation, parading in line down the side streets. He stamped his cold feet and wondered why so many of these people hated the British so. All we do is march around. Many of the soldiers had begun to seek part-time work in the town, some spending their off-duty hours working jobs that would ease the boredom and provide a little more cash than their low army pay. But there was resentment for that as well. The citizens protesting that the troops were taking valuable jobs badly needed by the men of Boston. It was not long before the resentment turned violent. He had seen some of the fights, most inspired by strong drink, a sudden and accidental confrontation in an alley or outside a pub. But the violence had continued to grow, the fights larger, and men on both sides had seemed to organize just a bit. Small gangs of citizens and troops, both looking for some satisfaction, some way to relieve the constant hostility. He had seen the man with the bloody wound 3 nights ago, the first real wound he had ever seen. He thought of the man, John Rogers, another young private, his skull split open. The anger in the barracks had brought the officers in, stern words, threats of punishment. But even the soldiers who had not been a part of the fights knew that there would be more violence. He had endured the insults himself, knew better than to walk the streets alone, even off duty, out of uniform. He still didn't understand the anger. For just keeping the peace. He said the words again in his mind, the first orders he had heard, even before they left the ship. Keep the peace. He moved his legs, stepped in place, tried to relieve the numbness in his feet. He leaned out past the protection of the guardhouse, felt a stiff breeze on his face, pulled back inside. It's pretty peaceful tonight. Too cold for the officers, that's certain. They're all inside, probably eating their hot food. He could see the main guard building and down the street the headquarters for His Majesty's forces. He felt a rumble in his stomach, began to think of the supper that waited for him back in the barracks. He could use a cup of tea right now. He tried to imagine the steam rolling up on his face, but the wind suddenly blew hard against the guardhouse, and now he could hear something else. Voices. Shouts. He leaned outside again, saw a group of men moving in the street, turning toward the custom house. He watched them, counted maybe a dozen, then saw more men coming around a corner a block down the street. He had been warned about the gangs, all the troops understanding that they were targets for the bands of rough young men. He shivered again, made 2 tight fists inside his coat, watched the men moving across the street, coming closer to the custom house. Now the voices were clear, and he saw one man point at him, felt his heart jump in his chest. They began to move straight toward the guardhouse, straight toward him. He pulled his hands from his coat, reached down, gripped the musket, leaned it up on his shoulder. "Make a good show," he thought. "No one will get past. They will not dare." He watched them move closer, realized they were young, teens perhaps. Saw one bend down, scooping up the snow, rolling an icy ball in his hands. There were more shouts, and suddenly the boy threw the snowball at the guardhouse. White flinched, heard the dull smack against the wall, felt his heart pounding, said aloud, "Move along now. This is no place for play." The faces were all looking at him, and he expected to see smiles, the playfulness of boys, but there was something new, unexpected, anger, and now more snowballs began to fly. The boys moved closer, their aim more true, and he felt a splatter of snow against his chest. The laughter came, but they did not move away. The fun was not over. White stepped outside the cover of the guardhouse, felt his own anger rising, looked at the faces, the voices jeering, calling out to him. One boy suddenly lunged closer, and White watched his hands, expecting something, another snowball, but the boy said, "What kind of man are you, a filthy lobsterback?" White tried to ignore the boy, glanced again at the door of the custom house, saw the door open slightly, faces peering out, the door closing again. White began to move toward the steps at the doorway, but the boy jumped in front of him, close, reached out and grabbed at the uniform, began to shout, "Dirty lobster back!" and White swung the musket around, the butt striking the boy's face. The boy fell backward, a sharp cry, and now there was silence from the mob as White stared at the boy. "My God, stop this! He moved up the steps of the custom house, close to the doorway, saw the young faces watching him, could see out past the mob now, more men coming forward, older men, some in suits, staying back, watching. He felt his hands shaking, tried to grip the musket, shouted, "Leave this place! Move away!" The injured boy was crying, shrieking, "You dirty scoundrel! I'll see you dead!" The voices began to answer, more curses, the boys moving closer again, the snowballs resumed, hitting the door of the custom house, and suddenly something dark flew past his head, a thick piece of wood, making a sharp, cracking sound against the wooden door behind him. He shouted again, "Back! Stay back!" He could feel his hands shaking, the icy numbness giving way to a rising wave of fear. The jeers from the mob were growing louder, and the officer's words suddenly came to him again, "Keep the peace." He clamped the musket under one arm. His hand, still shaking, reached inside the cartridge box at his waist. He felt the stiff paper with his numb fingers, fought through the pounding in his chest, the training taking hold, the fear giving way to the deliberate motion. He tore at the tip of the paper cartridge, poured powder into the pan at the breech, clamped down the lock. He set the butt of the musket down on the step, slowly slid the cartridge into the barrel of the musket, prodded it down the long barrel with the ramrod. Now he pulled out the bayonet, slid it hard on the barrel, a sharp twist, and lowered the barrel, pointed it out toward the crowd. His heart was racing, and he felt a surge of strength, the fear growing into raw excitement. He expected to see the fear in their faces, the respect for the soldier with the loaded musket, the great strength of the army, but the voices were louder still, and now another stick struck the door behind him. He could see more sticks, the crowd moving slowly forward, one voice shouting, "Shoot us! Go ahead, shoot us! You coward! Shoot us and be damned!" He gripped the musket hard, still felt his hands trembling violently, the cold now deep in his chest. He wanted to say something, anything, to move them away. At that moment he saw a man moving up to one side, well-dressed, a familiar face, and the man said, "Soldier, easy now. Do you mean to shoot?" "I will fire if they assault me." The man came up the steps, said, "Easy, young man. Take care. There need be no killing here." White glanced at the man's calm face. White nodded, felt a wave of relief, felt suddenly protected. Heard a second voice, that of an older man, say, "Move away! Don't molest this sentry! There is no fight here!" The mob began to quiet. Some of the boys backing away, the curses now slowing. He took a deep breath, thought, "Yes, move away. Let this end. Thank God!" Then there was a new sound. From a church tower, the sudden tolling of a bell echoing through the streets. Another bell began farther away. The faces began to turn away, looking toward the sound, the fire bell. The voices began again, but the sounds were different. Far down the street, more men began to emerge, and he could hear shouting, one word flowing from place to place, "Fire!" The sounds grew close, men suddenly moving out from a side street behind the custom house, the word echoing all through the crowd, "Fire!" Now the crowd pushed toward the custom house, some moving toward him, some lining up on the street. In front of him, the crowd came to life again, the faces turning toward him, and the curses rose once more. "Dirty scoundrel! Lobster back!" He felt the fear coming back, the icy grip in his chest. He could hear sounds above him, men at the windows. He wanted to shout at them, but there were no words. His face still watched the crowd, and now the sticks were raised again, the snow and ice striking the walls around him, a sharp stab suddenly in his chest, the heavy stick punching him. He looked out over the heads of the men closest to him, could see the main guard building, fought the fear, suddenly shouted, "Turn out the guard! Turn out the guard!" The people nearest to him began to move up the short steps, one man reaching out, grabbing at the musket. White jerked the gun to one side, swept the tip of the bayonet back and forth, forcing the men back. One boy shouted close to him, "Shoot us then!" White pressed his back hard against the door, still waving the bayonet toward the crowd, and said, "Damn you, I will shoot!" At that instant, there were new sounds, and he turned, saw a line of red emerging through the crowd, saw the tips of bayonets. The man who led the soldiers held a sword high, the coat brighter red, the man's chest crossed with bright yellow, the uniform of an officer, a familiar face. White said, "Sir, Captain Preston, sir!" He wanted to say more, to thank the officer, felt the sudden flood of relief. The crowd seemed to pull away, the mass of men and boys watching as the soldiers repeated what White had done, loading their muskets. Preston moved up onto the steps, said, "It's all right, Private. Fall in. Take position with the troops." White stepped quickly toward the line of soldiers, saw 8 men, all huge, the hand-picked elite, the grenadiers, all grim-faced. White moved among them, and the soldiers turned in quick rhythm, muskets held waist-high, pointing toward the crowd. White stood between 2 of the men, felt their strength, their power. The fear was gone, the excitement filling him, and he thought, "Now we will see. Now this mob will know." He felt the snowball hit his stomach, and at once the sticks were flying again, the shouts coming as before. Behind the mob, more men were pressing forward, some still shouting fire. Beyond, the bells still called to the town, the pealing growing louder, the sounds echoing, blending with the shouts of the mob. Captain Preston stepped out in front of the soldiers, glanced at White, then out at the crowd, said aloud, "We will march away from here. You will let us pass." There was a chorus of new voices, one man in front shouting, "Or you will shoot us? Go ahead, then, and damn you to hell!" Preston looked back at the soldiers, waved his hand toward the wall of the custom house, said, "Form here, flanks anchored against the wall." The men moved back, White following the flow. Those on each end of the line positioned themselves close to the front wall of the custom house, the others facing out in a short semicircle. Now Preston paced slowly in front of the troops, said to the crowd, "You will disperse. In the name of King George, I order you to return to your homes." White stood behind Preston, heard muttered curses from the soldiers on either side of him, their own anger building. Preston turned, said in a low voice, "None of that. We will move these people away. Do your duty." The crowd began to surge forward again. Hands began to reach for the muskets. Preston shouted again, "Disperse!" There were answers now, many voices, snowballs, more sticks. White saw something flash in the crowd, the bright brass of a saber. Suddenly, a man lunged forward at the troops, grabbed one musket by the barrel, tried to pull it away from the soldier who wrestled with his attacker. Another man stepped close, struck out at a bayonet with a long stick, knocking the musket from the soldier's hands. More men surged forward, tried to grab the musket, the soldier now on the ground, fists striking back. White fought the urge to help the soldier, held his musket straight toward the crowd, watched the faces, heard the voices louder still, the words flowing over the troops, the calls to fire, the screams of the mob, men powered by anger, hostility boiling into raw hatred, the sounds of the bells bursting in his ears, and now White looked to the side, saw the fallen soldier on his knees, pushing a man back, picking up the musket, screaming something White did not understand, a raw animal sound, and there was a blinding flash as the musket fired. White felt his heart leap, saw a man in the crowd go down, heard something from Preston, words, one word, "No!" Quickly there came more shots, the soldiers losing all control, the fear and the anger giving way. White felt the growing horror, but then the crowd was there, close in front, the screams and curses, the violence flowing over all of them. He saw someone holding a thick piece of wood, waving it over his head, the man still moving forward, and White raised the musket to his shoulder, fought through the roar of sound in his ears, the church bells, the muskets now blasting smoke and fire on either side of him, the sounds of terror from the crowd. He gripped the musket hard, held it tight to his shoulders, the fear in his heart giving way to the madness now washing over them all. The man stalked toward him, brandishing the stick as some deadly club, shouting words, angry, awful sounds. White watched him move close, and then the man stopped, stared at the muzzle of the musket, seemed suddenly calm, looked at White's face, deep into his eyes, and the sounds gave way to the man's words, soft through the chiming of the church bells. White could not hold back, the terror and the anger too strong, and as he pulled the trigger, he heard the man say, "You cannot kill us all." Chapter 2. Adams. He had heard the first bell, reacted as they all reacted, responding to the awful threat of fire by moving outside, finding the flow of the people in the street, moving to help in any way he could. Fire was the greatest fear in a town with so many wooden buildings, and by now it was reflex as well as custom that brought the people into the street. He was still pulling on his coat when he saw men running toward the center of town, and he shouted, "Where is the fire?" One man slowed, seemed to recognize him. "There is no fire, Mr. Adams. The British have started a riot. The custom house." The man ran off, and Adams stopped, saw the people moving past him, many carrying sticks, clubs, one man with a pistol. He thought, "The British? Soldiers don't riot." He began to move, following the crowd, could hear louder sounds now, screams, the bells still ringing above him. He turned a corner and was surprised to see people flooding toward him. He saw fear and terror in the faces. He pushed past them, but one man shoved him, nearly knocking him down, and so he stood aside, out of the street, waiting for the surge to pass by. A minute later he made his way forward again toward King Street, rounded another corner. The street was wider, and he could see the old State House and, to one side, the Custom House. Now he stopped, saw the crowd thinning out, saw a mass of red, a thick line of troops spreading out around the Custom House, two small cannon moving into place. People still moved in both directions, some in a panic, some coming forward, as he was, to see what had happened. Another man ran past him, shouting, "They will kill us! They're going to kill us!" Adams felt a sudden wave of confusion. Looked toward the troops again, saw an officer guiding them, more officers now, one man on a horse. He saw muskets, bayonets pointing at the thinning crowd. The people moving away in a wave saw the muskets pointing at him, felt the stab of panic. What has happened? He felt his breathing in hard gasps, moved closer to the troops. There can be no danger here. They cannot just shoot us. They have commanders. They know the law. The area close to the soldiers had been cleared, and for a brief moment there was little sound, the soldiers standing quietly, the shouts of the people muted, most of the crowd gone. He eased along the side of the street, looked at the officers, wanted to ask someone, "This is no riot, it cannot be so bad." Now he heard a short scream, looked down a side street, saw a man being dragged by the shoulders, the man's face covered in blood, his shirt bloody too, a smear of red trailing him in the snow. The man was pulled into a doorway, and now there was a woman kneeling, wiping with a cloth. Adams stared at the scene for a long moment. What did he do that they would shoot him? He turned toward the troops again, silent stares, no motion, and he noticed the dark red stains in the snow in front of them. He moved slowly toward the open area, ignoring the troops. He heard a voice, a soldier moving toward him, looked up to see a familiar face, the man's name not coming. "Mr. Adams, this is no place for you. Go home now." Adams stared at the dark smears on the snow, felt suddenly sick. "What happened here?" "It is not your concern, sir. The situation is under control. I must insist you return to your home." Adams looked at the man, wanted to ask again, felt a cold numbness. "There is blood in the street." "It is not your concern, sir. I will ask you again." "Not my concern? You have shot citizens. This will concern us all." He sagged through the doorway, removed his hat, held it for a long moment, staring down at nothing. He heard sounds, the quick footsteps, a small voice. His daughter burst into the front room, ran to him, grabbed him around the leg. "Papa, papa, papa." He looked at her, reached one hand down, touched the short curls, hair like fine silk, moved his fingers slowly, gently, could not push her away. "There now, Nabby, come, leave your father be." Abigail had come into the room, looked at him with dark concern, said again, "Here, Nabby, now." The little girl released her grip, moved to her mother with a pout, and Adams watched her sink into Abigail's skirt, one thumb lodged firmly in her mouth. Abigail murmured, "Something terrible has happened. I can see it in your face." Adams nodded slowly, blinked hard. "The soldiers have fired on the citizens. At least four are dead, maybe more. I heard it was a riot, but I don't know." Abigail moved to a small, soft chair, sat slowly, clumsily, the roundness of her stomach obvious. Adams moved forward instinctively to provide a helping hand, though she said, "No, it's all right. I just need to sit." "I'm sorry. I should not have gone out. I knew you would worry." He paused, glanced at his daughter, holding fast to her mother's leg, and he lowered his voice. "I saw the blood. It was everywhere." He moved close to her, closed his eyes. "I should not have gone." She held out her hand, took his. "You had to go. It could have been a fire, and you know you would help. You would have to know what happened." "I still don't know. We will hear the rumors tomorrow. Both sides will lay blame. There will be mobs, maybe more violence." He knelt down, rubbed one hand gently on his daughter's back, said, "Perhaps you should return to Braintree. It's safer. We could be in some danger here if things get out of hand." "No, John. There is no danger if we're together. I will not cower away like some weak and helpless damsel while you face the dragon alone. Where's my sword?" He knew she was trying to cheer him up. He looked at her again, couldn't help but stare at the roundness under her dress. A pregnant woman fighting off the great evils of the world. It's an inspiring image. "Do you need armor?" She laughed, squeezed his hand. "You are my armor." She rubbed her stomach again, suddenly seeming uncomfortable, and he backed away. "Are you sure you're all right?"
"Don't worry, John. There are no problems. He kicked today, hard."
Adams was curious. "He? Why do you say that?"
"I said he kicked hard more than once. He's tired of being inside, like his father. Only your son would be so expressive, so stubborn. He's already strong."
The word hit him, rolled in his mind, strong. And he saw the sadness in her eyes betraying her smile. He thought of Susanna now, the frail baby gone barely a month. She had been their third child, had lived only 2 months past her first birthday. The shock had been extraordinary, the first great tragedy of their marriage. The death of children was a horror common in the town, but they had seemed to be immune, their first 2 children growing into healthy toddlers. But Susanna had never been healthy, and Adams had felt himself pulling away from the baby, as though he knew in some dark place that she would not survive. He could never have admitted that to Abigail. And he kept his sadness hidden away as she nurtured the weak baby, doing everything in a mother's heart to strengthen the infant's fragility. When the baby died, Abigail had been devastated, and Adams had begun to worry for her health as well. He had felt helpless, even afraid for her as she cried over the small grave, her hands self-consciously moving over the growing bulge in her stomach. He saw her own fear for the health of their new baby, still unborn. He moved to the front window, looked out through the darkness at the open square, the courthouse across the street. He was used to seeing troops in formation there, right in front of his house, the constant drilling, the presence that even the most reasonable citizens had begun to dread, the annoying show of strength. "Well, they have truly shown their strength now," he thought. "It will be hard for the Tories to excuse this, to claim some conspiracy against the king. It could simply have been one mob facing another, and the men in the red uniforms were better armed. There are so many questions. I will know more tomorrow. I have to know. There is still law here. And no matter who is to blame, whether this disaster was born from evil intent or blind foolishness, if the mobs gain control, then God help us."
This ends Disc 1.